This is a Maisie Media production.
This episode is brought to you by Cricket Wireless. It's a new year and it's time for new possibilities. And do we ever need them? Cricket Wireless can help you make the easy switch to the plan that's just right for you, starting at $30 a month. Smile and switch to Cricket. Activation and other fees and restrictions apply. Terms subject to change. See store for details. During the Switch Pivot or Quit chats, we talk to women who have successfully navigated through some of the plot twist years of life and are eager to share their stories and what they've learned in the hopes of inspiring, teaching, or making even the slightest impact by candidly owning their truth. Hey girl, hey, and thanks for dropping in to the Switch Pivot or Quit podcast. Candid convo for the girl needing a lifestyle plot twist when she's deciding if it's time to switch, pivot, or quit. I'm Ayana Angel, a former sports entertainment publicist in New York City, turned traditionally published author with Simon & Schuster, who quit my old life to write a book, live in London for a bit, and explore my dreams to find my happiness and fulfillment. I'm here to help encourage and guide you through your plot twist years as your chief encourager and host of this podcast, Switch, Pivot, or Quit. Our community is continuously growing, so welcome to all the new listeners, and thank you all for those who are returning. If you love what you hear on the Switch Pivot or Quit podcast and want to show your love, head over to iTunes and leave us a review. A review just helps more people know about the podcast, and it helps to continue to amplify our voices as women in the space. Now, if you just can't get enough, come hang out with us on Instagram by following me at ayana.angel, and that's ayiana.angel, or drop by our website, switchpivotorquit.com. Now let's get this conversation started. On today's episode, we are diving into our cracking corporate content. I hope you guys are ready. This episode features Lydia Finette, who is Global Managing Director, Strategic Partnerships, and Lead Benefit Auctioneer at Christie's Auction House. She's led auctions for more than 600 organizations and raised over $500 million for nonprofits globally. Lydia is responsible for conceptualizing and spearheading the development of the firm's Global Strategic Partnerships Division, which has generated over $25 million in revenue to date. Lydia is represented by CAA and travels internationally as a keynote speaker, helping people unlock their sales potential and empowering women in the workplace. She was named one of New York's most influential women by Gotham Magazine and has been featured in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and has appeared in Vogue, Harper's Bazaar, Vanity Fair, and more. Her amazing career has also afforded her the opportunity to release a widely acclaimed book, The Most Powerful Woman in the Room Is You, which was published by Simon & Schuster. You guys are going to love this conversation. Like I said to you before, the Cracking Corporate Conversations offer us an inside look at high-achieving professional women, and I know that you're going to gain so much from this conversation with Lydia. So let's get into it. Lydia, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you so much for having me.
No problem, of course. So let's dive right into this conversation. Tell us a little bit about your background and how you got to where you are in your career and where you are presently.
Well, I currently work in the auction world, where I've worked for the past 20 years. Mm-hmm. I really didn't know anything about the auction world when I was growing up, but it was something I read about in a magazine article when I was in college. Uh-huh. And I think a large part of my personality I've learned as I've gotten older is that the easiest way for me to make something happen is to talk about it endlessly. And I think my job would be the perfect case of that. having no contacts really in the auction world, I just started talking about it to every single person that I could get any information from. And it just, by chance, I met someone who worked in the auction world, and she gave me the information for the internship coordinator at Christie's Auction House, where I work now. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of the beginning of it all. I stalked the internship coordinator for couple of weeks until she finally relented and let me into the program that was already closed. And that was the beginning really of it all.
Okay.
And since that time, I've been at Christie's Auction House for 20 years.
Do you think that there's anything that you've learned about being persistent in your career that's maybe been sort of eye-opening for you?
Absolutely. Truly, one of the most important things about being successful is being unafraid to go back and ask again. Mm. And I think it's something in my earlier career, and frankly, I think I see it even in a lot of young women. They're afraid to ask for things because they fear the word no.
Right.
And so persistence is one of those things that once you learn that without it, you won't really get what you want. You put yourself out there, even though you have to kind of fight through that ick feeling that you might get when you know there's something you want, but there's a barrier between you and what you want.
How or when did you find your voice in your career?
I found my voice in my career. Probably the most formative moment that I talk about in my book a lot is this moment when I realized that I was being underpaid, really significantly underpaid for what I was doing, not only within the market, but also even internally in my job.
And mention the name of your book again, just in case people are curious.
Absolutely. It's called The Most Powerful Woman in the Room Is You. It's actually the chapter that a lot of people reach out to me about after they read it, because I think to speak so openly about a moment when I realized that I was literally making a third of what I should be making in my job. And I went in and I faked a job offer to get the job offer that I wanted. People are sort of like, I can't believe you wrote that in a book. Where when I still work for the same company. But I guess, you know, two things. First of all, it was 10 years ago. But secondly, it was the most important part of my career, because without that moment, I would not be in the position that I'm in today. I probably would have left and I wouldn't have had the next 10 years of this career, which have been the most incredible 10 years of my life in my working life. And so I felt like sharing it, frankly, at this point, if I don't share it, well, what good was it? What did it do? It only served me at that point. And by telling this story, hopefully I can push women to really think about what they're making and have those conversations with the women around them, which I feel like now is a much broader conversation. But 10 years ago, we did not talk about what we'd made with other people. So it was fun to share that. And it was kind of fun, frankly, even to see my parents' reaction when I told them that I was putting it in the book. My mother sort of said, I feel like that's something you should probably just could have kept to yourself. And I called my sister and I said, you know, the funny thing is when mom said that, it made me realize how badly I needed to write it, because that's the problem, right? We've shut our doors and we have these conversations with each other and nothing changes. But what if you put it in a book? And what if it's something that people talk about? And even if they talk about it in closed doors at the beginning, maybe it sparks interest in someone to push a little further or to ask another question. And that's really what a book is about.
I think, you know, a lot of us just in general, as a society, we have a negative connotation around talking about money. And in any sort of respect, whether it be your debt or your income or anything, you know, except what we're spending on social media.
On social media. And then even then you continue to question that because you don't know if whether or not someone just picked it up and is taking a picture of it, they actually own it, which is another thing.
Right, exactly. So do you have any thoughts behind sort of how someone can take the approach to maybe being a little bit more assertive with the financial aspect of their career now? Because as you mentioned, that was 10 years ago. Maybe the you now wouldn't have done it exactly like that. Or maybe there are things that you've learned now that would help you navigate that type of situation a little bit different. What are your thoughts on how a woman could approach a similar situation today?
I think that, you know, in my case, it was one of those moments where I wasn't even intending to say those things. I wasn't intending to tell them that I was leaving. I was just going to say that I had a job offer on the table. And I just sort of saw this opportunity and realized that I was just going to go for it. I think if I, in this day and age now, and the way that I work now, I would have done a lot more preparation. I would have had a lot more conversations with people around me and above me to ensure that people knew that I wanted to grow and make more money. Because the problem with a situation like that is not everyone's going to be in a situation where they can walk in and say that they're leaving and everybody will scramble to make it happen where they stay.
Right.
What is much more effective, and what I always say to my team, come talk to me and let me know what it's going to take to keep you here. Because then we can have an honest dialogue about whether or not we can get to that place. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I work for a company, there is a certain amount of money that goes towards raises and bonuses and salaries in general. And so I have to know moving forward what people really want in order for them to be happy here and not to have to come into my office and say, I'm leaving tomorrow if you don't give me what I want.
Right.
Because that's a really difficult scramble. You know, mid-year with no other resources at your disposal, the answer a lot of times is probably going to be like, I don't want you to leave, but I don't have an option. But if you've given me a year to work with you to get to you to that salary or however long it will take in the process of your company, if you can do it around appropriate bonus time or appropriate raise time, those are effective ways to work. And frankly, it gets your boss on board because mm-hmm. you want your boss to support you, and your boss definitely wants to support you if you're a good worker. So, you know, I would say think of it more as starting the day you walk in the door, have an open dialogue with your boss and the people around you about what your hopes and expectations are so that you're aligned and you don't feel like I did that they were completely letting you down by paying you so little because you hadn't done your research and you hadn't gotten people on your side on the way up.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of management, what's one thing that you've learned that's crucial in being an effective manager?
That no two people can be managed the same. I think a really good manager understands that there are different levers within everyone who works for you, and you need to understand what motivates them to motivate them. Mm-hmm. And I know that sounds kind of strange, but you know, there are people who need a gold star. They need that email on the weekend that said, hey, I just wanted to let you know, I've noticed all the work you're doing. You're doing a great job. And that from that person will get you 3 weeks of great work product. And then the next, like 3 weeks later, you need to just shoot one more email and let them know that one more time. Yeah. Because there are other people. I mean, I definitely am not someone who needs a gold star. I kind of work for myself. And I know if I feel like I'm doing a good job, it doesn't really matter to me what other people think, because I know if I'm putting in 110% and 110% is not good enough, I'm still trying my hardest. Mm. And so I would say that I would manage myself very differently than I would manage someone on the team who, you know, needs a gold star or really values their time off, you know, and maybe giving them an extra vacation day over the course of the year, or an extra vacation week where they can go explore something that they're interested in might buy you more time with them over the course of their career and more loyalty, which I think as a boss is probably the most important thing you can have.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny that you mentioned the word loyalty, because that hasn't really come up in a lot of the conversations that I've been having regarding cracking corporate. What role do you think that plays, or how should employees approach loyalty? Being that, you know, we're in this, I guess, this environment where a lot of times it feels like employees aren't loyal and companies aren't loyal. So it's sometimes it feels a little challenging to know which side of the fence you should show up on, or how you mm-hmm. should show up, and how much effort you should put into developing that relationship. What are your thoughts on that with regard to being in the corporate space and just maybe being a person who is loyal, or trying to be a person who is more loyal?
I think that loyalty is the most important part of a working environment, honestly. Mm-hmm. I feel like I have seen time and time again leaders who have risen to the top by stepping over people and doing things behind their back. Mm-hmm. And then they get to the top, and the minute that something goes wrong, they have 50 people trying to pull them back down.
Right.
And the leaders who have loyal employees, when something goes wrong, it's almost like they're circling the wagons around that person, and they are making sure that their person is taken care of, and they're putting themselves in the line of fire. And those are the leaders I want to get behind. And so I always try to remember that when things are happening in my team. Like, I think that they would tell you I'm the first person to take the fall, because at the end of the day, I know ultimately the responsibility lies with me. It doesn't matter what happens on my team. At the end of the day, it's my responsibility. Mm-hmm. And I want them to be loyal, because I want them to understand that I support them, and I want them to support me on a human level. Mm-hmm. And loyalty doesn't mean that you stay at a company for the rest of your life. Loyalty certainly means that you just, even if that person moves on to a different company, they still understood that at the core, you always had their back.
Right.
And hopefully they feel the same way to you.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I mean by loyalty. People won't always stay with a company. I mean, you know, it's very rare to find people who've been in a company for 20 years, especially in this day and age. Mm-hmm. But I will tell you that the women who've worked for me and the men who've worked with me over the years, I can think of very few that are not still people that I could easily call at any time to ask a question or to, you know, say, I've got this really amazing person who's working for me. Could I send them to you for an informational interview? Or let's grab a cup of coffee if I'm in town. And that to me is what true loyalty is about. It's about sort of finding that human connection, being a good manager to someone, and as an employee, being loyal to the people who show you that loyalty.
Mm-hmm. With advancement in mind, how does one prepare to maybe land the next role, either internally or externally?
In my opinion, landing a job is all about networking. I would say the person who's at the top of my list who is someone who's recommended by someone who used to work for me.
Okay.
Because they understand, like, what, you know, the auction world is crazy in a sense because it's so fast paced.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we do auctions day after day, year after year. And there's just a certain amount of flexibility you need in your personality to be able to work in this world because it is always changing and the property that's coming in is different every day. And you may have to go on a plane here and a plane there. So there has to be sort of an intellectual curiosity and a flexibility. And really, you need a 360 thinker. And so I always love getting a resume from someone who used to work for me who says, I don't know if you have an opening on your team right now, but if you do, this person would be perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, a lot of the sort of next part of networking, especially if you are in a job and you want to move up, is aligning yourself with people who you think could have the job that you want. Mm-hmm. Because at some point, I mean, look, I've been here for 20 years, but maybe that's it. You know, at some point people do leave or they mm-hmm. go on to do something else or, you know, they retire. I mean, even that could be an option too. And, you know, if you've been there for long enough and you know enough about their role, it's an easy sort of way to be part of a succession plan internally.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think externally, if you're looking to move, it's all about the informational interviews and asking people to introduce you to people. I mean, LinkedIn to me is the most amazing tool in the entire world.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many people have reached out to me since the book came out just to connect or to ask to have a cup of coffee. Mm-hmm. I try to do 2 informational interviews a week just to meet new people, to get new perspectives on things, or even just to do sort of career coaching along the way, because I think that's always helpful for young women and men who are going up in their career.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, LinkedIn allows you to get to the CEO of a company if you want. And mm-hmm. whether or not they email you back, you still have reached out to them, you
mm-hmm.
know? So there are just so many tips at our disposal for networking in this day and age. And I just feel like the more people you know, the greater your network is and the easier it is to leverage those contacts to find what you really want to do if you're not in the job that you currently want.
Mm-hmm. Can you think of any meaningful ways to inspire curiosity or discovery in individuals or teams or departments when you're feeling like, maybe things are dipping off a bit. We need to do something to get people excited again.
You know, one thing that I've always tried to put in the job performance when we go through the performance review every year is find one thing personally to develop. It can be internal, it can be external, it can be something that feeds into your job. I mean, mm-hmm. easier for us with partnerships, but you know, if someone's interested in wine, I say to them, go take a class on wine if you need to leave early and then bring back that knowledge and let's do some wine partnerships.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think that allowing everyone to have something that's external that really drives them only feeds back into what they do in their own job. Because mm-hmm. the biggest issue, I think, in my opinion, of things that people run into in their job is, especially if they're doing a job that's very 9-to-5, it's sort of day in and day out.
Right.
They feel like that's their limit, right? They can only do that and that's mm-hmm. it. But in fact, if your job is from 9-to-5, even if you have children, like there's time at night
mm-hmm.
and there's, you know, I'm not an early morning riser, but certainly those evening hours. I mean, I wrote my entire book after my kids went to bed in 3 months.
Yeah. And you did
and
it.
I always,
it's done.
And I did
it's
it.
It's out.
Yes. It is out. It came out in April. The most powerful
yeah.
woman in the room is you. It has been out, you know, since last April. And honestly, as a result of that time spent of digging deep for those 3 months, never having been as stressed in my entire life, I was still nursing my third child while I was writing this book at night.
Wow.
But what I learned from that experience was that there are so many hours in the day that, you know, I was flopped on the couch watching Netflix or going through Instagram or, mm-hmm. you know, just doing things that don't actually improve my life. They're interesting for the moment, but, you know, what is that really doing when I'm scrolling through Instagram at night and I've just wasted an hour doing it? It's fun, right? I wish that I were in 9 of the places I've seen on my Instagram feed, certainly. But how is that improving my life? How is that improving me? And how am I helping others when I'm doing that? Mm-hmm. And so I think sometimes just like pausing to ask those questions is important too.
This episode is brought to you by Cricket Wireless. It's the time of year when we focus on being smarter than we were the year before. That means losing the excess baggage of what just doesn't serve us anymore. Cricket Wireless invites you to leave behind that excess wireless bloat that locks you into paying for plan features you don't use and you don't need. Switch to Cricket Wireless and get the plan that's just right for you, starting at $30 per month. We're Cricket Wireless, and it's just how we do it. Activation and other fees and restrictions apply. Terms subject to change. See store for details. When you're looking at creating value for yourself within a company, there was a listener question that said, how do I ensure that people value the work that I do? Do you have any thoughts on that?
You have to tell them what mm-hmm. you're doing. Mm-hmm. You really have to be your biggest advocate, because nobody knows what you do over the course of the day. And right. I say this to people all the time. I have 3 children at home, and I go home and I put them to bed, and then I go back out and take auctions at night. And there was a point where I was writing a book at night. I have no idea what you're doing other than right. the things that I'm asking you to do. Mm-hmm. So tell me, come in and make a monthly meeting with me or a biweekly meeting to update me on what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Because that is how you show people the value that you're adding. Mm-hmm. And if you find yourself in a project that you have single-handedly sort of been the person who's spearheading the project, and no one is noticing that, tell people and make sure that they know, because otherwise, I promise you, days and years pass and nobody will notice. Don't right. think that someone is going to pluck you out of your cubicle in the middle of the day and be like, you are a shining star. That does not happen. It is only by you saying to people, you know, I've been doing X, but I've also been doing Y, and I'd love to show you for 5 minutes of your day. It doesn't have to be an hour. I'd love to just spend 5 minutes talking you through this project that I've been working on. Mm. And take those opportunities to grow your own career as well. Mm-hmm. Again, be your own advocate. It's the most important part of work. And again, I think women are not as good at it as men. Mm-hmm. So I would say to any female who's listening, remember that it's okay to be the most powerful woman in the room. And that is the person who is promoting themselves to other people, because no one will ever do it for you the way that you can do it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about, because when you said that, you know, it made me think back to your book. And in the beginning, you talk about how you walked into a room, an auction room, and you couldn't get their attention. And you started banging your mallet or your gavel to kind of like get their attention. And now that's like your signature thing that you do. Tell us a little bit more about, and I thought that really made an impression on me, because we can all imagine standing in front of a room full of people who are not paying you any attention, but yet they should be. And you're like, oh my gosh, this is so embarrassing. Yet I have to do something. Like, what do I do? You know?
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit more about what you do in your day to day and how the auctions at night come in to play as well, just so we can have an idea of sort of like what you're charged with doing and what the scope of the business is that you're in.
So when I'm in my office during the day, I run a team of women and men around the world who deal with all the partnerships for Christie's. So mm-hmm. if there's a car company that wants to work with Christie's, we create the package for that partnership and sell it to the partner. Mm-hmm. So we're a revenue generating department within the company. Mm-hmm. And I talk in the book a lot about the fact that when I started in events, this was, you know, 20 years ago, sponsorships weren't really done that much. And so right. there was a lot of pushback around allowing anyone else to co-brand anything or do anything mm-hmm. with Christie's, because we felt like our brand was so strong. Why would we associate with other people? I saw it as a revenue stream. And that was what I referred to earlier, 10 years later, when I was renegotiating my salary, I described this department that I wanted to start called Strategic Partnerships. And so that's what I've been running internally at Christie's for the past 10 years. And then, as I said, after my day job is finished, I go home, you know, I help, we have a wonderful nanny who's there during the day when I'm at work, mm-hmm. and I'll help her bathe the kids and get the kids into pajamas, and depending how late until I have to get on stage, like sometimes it's 8 or 9 at night, sometimes it's 7:30, and my kids are typically in bed around 7. My husband comes home, our nanny leaves at 6:30, and my husband comes home, and essentially we sort of trade off wherever that is. If it's later, I can sort of spend some time hanging out with him. If not, then I sort of high five him on the way out the door. like, can you zip my dress and get the top because I can't reach it, kind of the situation, which is great because there have been a couple of times where I had to run quickly and then all of a sudden realized that the top of my dress wasn't zipped.
That's the worst.
I know, it really is the worst. Or a bracelet wouldn't go on because I couldn't hook it. Yeah. But yeah, these are real problems. But then I get on stage. I go to charity galas all over New York City, and I stand on stage and I raise money for nonprofits. And so I get on stage in front of anywhere from, I would say the smallest crowd is probably 400 people to, I mean, I take an auction with 6,000 people in the audience.
Wow.
And so for me, that gavel strike, as you were talking about, is that moment for me where all of a sudden I'm getting the crowd's attention and pulling them into this 10 or 20 or 30 minute auction and trying to engage them despite the fact that they have no interest in buying what I'm selling. You know, I always say the difference between art auctioneering, which is what we do here at Christie's in the building, where we're selling things that you'd find in a museum a lot of the time, like Picasso's and Monet's and beautiful jewelry and
things
wine.
Things that people really want.
Yes, they have thought about them. They have allocated an amount of money. We hope that they come here and spend more. You know, that is really what's happening when someone comes into the doors at Christie's. But in a charity gala, a lot of people have just gone there as maybe their friend bought a table and they get to sit there, or maybe their company bought a table and they get to sit there and enjoy a lovely meal and entertainment. And then I'm thrown on stage, and I would say 80% of the people didn't even realize there was going to be an auction component to this charity gala. So they have no intention of buying anything or even listening. And again, a lot of the times everything is really expensive. So most of the people would never even be able to afford what I'm selling on in that stage at that moment. Mm-hmm. So I always see the crowd as like, I have to get all of your attention, even though 92% of you have no intention of bidding and frankly couldn't even afford what I'm selling, and I have to keep it. So in the book, I talk about that gavel for me. You know, the first time I did it, I used the handle of the gavel, which you sort of see on Judge Judy, you know, and I slammed it down. And the thing is, you're not really supposed to slam those gavels that many times. And it just broke off and rolled under the podium. So there I was in my cocktail dress, crawling under the podium to pick up the gavel. And I mean, I think the audience at that point had already lost interest, so they didn't even notice because they were talking. It was absolutely humiliating. But I've learned over time, I can't falter after that gavel hits, because when that gavel hits, I have, you know, 10 seconds to captivate the audience and really bring them along for a ride. And, you know, I've learned little tricks along the way. You know, I'll slam down the gavel and say something like, ladies and gentlemen, they've given me 15 minutes for this auction, but I said, let's get it done in 5, shall we? I know you guys want to keep on dancing or having drinks or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. And that'll keep their attention. And all of a sudden, even though I know it's going to take 15 minutes, they think it's going to take 5. And they're like, okay, I'll pay attention for 5 minutes.
But
I talk about the strike method. That's what I call it in the book, because I use it even without the gavel. Like I had a huge meeting last week with our CEO, and I could feel myself getting really nervous before the meeting. And I just kept saying, all you need to do is line up that first line. What is that line that comes the minute you're ready to launch into your pitch? Because once you say it, the nerves start to dissipate and then you feel solid and ready to go.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I was going to ask you about, you know, presentations and just being in that environment where you're on the spot. It's you. You have to produce. You have to show up. You have to perform, if you will. What is that experience like for you overall? And when was the first time that you had to do it? And did you feel prepared? And if you weren't prepared then, how did you start preparing yourself for these moments?
Well, I think for me, it really goes back to figuring out my first line more than anything. I know that sounds like a very small thing, but what happens a lot of times whenever you're going into a meeting and when you are a performer, you recognize the adrenaline rush, you know, that feeling like you've passed a cop going 150 miles an hour and you're like, I'm about to get a ticket. It's just like, you feel like you have ice water that's flooding through your veins.
Mm-hmm.
When you're a performer, what you know is that adrenaline is what gets you great. It goes from good to great with that adrenaline, and it gets you so laser focused because adrenaline is very powerful. And so you get the same thing on a smaller scale when you go into a meeting with people who you really respect or people who are senior to you in a company who you might be a little bit intimidated by. Mm-hmm. So you need to think about using that adrenaline. And the easiest way to do it is really focus on what you're going to say at the beginning so you don't get flustered. Because that's when you start to spiral, when you can't speak or, you know, your words get sort of jarbled and then all of a sudden you're so self-conscious. I'm messing this up. I don't know what to do. So you want to just have that first line and what's going to come after it really laser focused into your mind so that you don't forget. Mm-hmm. And then once you start talking, it's also about being very communicative with the people in front of you. So even if when you're speaking to them, make sure that you're watching. Because you want to make sure that if they're getting tired or they're getting distracted or they're not paying attention, that you need to ask them a question or use a gesture. I always think that the most amazing thing in a presentation is when something goes wrong, because that's your opportunity to get their attention again. So a cell phone rings in the middle of a presentation, a quick, oh, just tell that person I say hi.
Right.
We'll always make everyone kind of laugh and refocus on you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if something, as a charity auctioneer, I mean, I can't even tell you the things that go wrong. People drop plates in front of me in the middle of things. I had a person who, you know, fell off of their chair once. I don't know if they had too much to drink or they just missed their chair. But, you know, even the auction I took on Sunday night, I started the auction with my strike method and a guy in the front stood up and I think he was going to the bathroom, but I said to the audience, you know, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I started the whole strike method moment. And then this guy stands up to leave. And I said, well, obviously I'm killing it. People are already leaving. And he laughed. He's like, I'm just going to the restaurant. But it ingratiates you with the audience and it makes you feel calm and then you feel natural. And that's what people are interested in watching. People want someone who feels authentic.
Right.
And I always say that in speeches, like watch a speech of a really good speaker and watch how easy they are with the audience. That is what you should strive for. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be formal and stiff. That doesn't get you anywhere. People zone out. Mm-hmm. You want to be authentic and human and people will be drawn in.
I know my people, and if you're anything like me, as a podcast listener, you're also multitasking. You're zipping around the house, you're running errands, you're doing all the things. I'm sure that's you, right? Because it's me too. But another thing that we have in common is our familiarity with Walgreens. Who doesn't know about Walgreens? But did you know about my Walgreens? Well, it's not my Walgreens, it's yours. Well, it's really ours. Okay, all you need to know is that it's the new, easier way to shop, save, and stay well. And now you can order online and pick up in as little as 30 minutes curbside drive-through or in-store. Right now, get 20% off purchases of $30 or more with the code SPQ when you order online or use the new Walgreens app. Again, that's code SPQ for 20% off your purchases of $30 or more. Order online or with the new Walgreens app today, and you'll be saving time in no time. Offer valid online through January 23rd, 2021 on qualifying same-day orders. Must be signed into your Walgreens.com account to redeem. Additional restrictions apply. See Walgreens.com/offer details and Walgreens.com/pickup for details. Did you do anything to sort of prepare yourself as you realize that I'm coming into this space where I'm going to need to be in front of people on a regular basis, capture their attention or command a room, whether it be in the boardroom or in an auction setting? Did you do anything maybe outside of work to help you prepare for those roles or that role?
I took the charity auctioneering class in terms of the tryouts. So I went to the tryouts completely cold. I didn't know what I was walking into. I knew what I had seen from the charity auctioneers who I had seen take charity auctions. And I knew that I felt I could do it and possibly do it differently, which could be sort of fun. I just didn't know what that was going to look like.
Right.
So I tried out and I did exactly what I'd seen all of them do because I didn't really know what my style was going to be. So I just stuck with that for many, many years. Mm-hmm. And I probably took about 500 auctions. I'm not kidding. 500 auctions. Wow. that all felt very mediocre because I was just sort of doing exactly what other people had done. So I would say that while I did not prepare, even when the auctions were very mediocre and I left feeling pretty deflated after most of them, mm-hmm. I still went back. So I kept pushing myself to go back, even though I didn't feel like I was great at it. And I would say that that really, for me, would be the biggest, that would be the biggest lesson to impart on other people. Just keep going back to it, even if you don't feel like you're good at it, because there will be a breakthrough moment. Hopefully it won't take you 500 auctions like it did me. But no one gets good at anything the first time.
Right.
You know, it's not even that you need to fail time and time again, although I do think that's a very important part of life, because you obviously over a time, once you stop caring so much about failure, you'll just keep putting yourself out there and the opportunities will get bigger. But I also think to get better, you just have to push and push and push and push yourself out of your comfort zone. So let's say you give a presentation for 10 people and you feel like it just was totally flat. Mm-hmm. Sit down and write down what you think went wrong. And the next time you have a presentation, get a bunch of your friends in the room or get your iPhone and try the presentation again and then pick it apart. Mm-hmm. Think to yourself, why was that so boring? What could I have done differently? You know, Tim in the front row looked like he was yawning halfway through. Maybe I should have mentioned that. You know, think through your performance. Think through those moments of presentation and think about what you could do better. Because then you'll start to understand the things that were good and you can start focusing on those. Mm-hmm. And that makes it fun. Like when I realized humor could be a huge part of what I was doing, then I really started to ramp it up. And that was when I felt like I really started to enjoy being on stage.
So you spoke about authenticity before. I want to talk a little bit about authenticity with respect to showing up in the workplace. There's a lot of talk about diversity and inclusion now. It's sort of like everyone has to have a D&I department or some way that they're approaching it. But that doesn't always mean that people still feel comfortable being completely and wholly themselves when they show up into their work environment. Especially, I would say, a lot of women of color, and I know myself being a Black woman, a lot of times when I would show up into corporate, I would feel, I would, number one, be the only one in the room that looked like me. And then sometimes I would feel as though I couldn't be my whole self because a part of it would be questioned or scrutinized or something that wouldn't just go over. And sometimes it's easier to just show up in a room and just to let things just go easy. And, you know, almost it, sometimes I feel like that can then almost make you be unnoticed sometimes too, because you're holding something back. What are your thoughts on being who you are and showing up in a space where you know it may not be what's normal, what's expected? Especially, I really want to hear about this from you, because you're in the auction world, and that's a prestigious world. And sometimes everybody doesn't fit. Just be honest, you know?
Totally.
And you don't see people that, you know, you may not see a lot of variety in that world. So what are your thoughts on authenticity and just people showing up as they are, and how do you navigate that if you know clearly there's a difference?
I mean, I dealt with this from a very early age. I mean, I went to boarding school, which I know people always ask me if I did something wrong. I promise I didn't. My mom is British, so I hope that helps explain why I went to boarding school.
Yes.
I actually wanted to go. I was very excited to go. But I went to boarding school in Connecticut, and I grew up in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. And if you grow up in Louisiana, in the Deep South, mm-hmm. you have an accent. Like mm-hmm. I had a definite Southern accent, and I arrived at boarding school, and the first 2 years that I was there, pretty much everything I said was repeated back to me in my Southern drawl. And it's amazing how quickly at the age of 13, your accent starts to dull. Mm-hmm. And I mean, most people now say to me that they can't place where I'm from.
Right.
I have such a neutral accent. But when they ask me why, even though I'm from the South, I always say, I think it's because of those years in boarding school. Mm-hmm. Because I didn't want to be different. I didn't want to stick out. I was 13 years old. I was also 5'11". So I was already sticking out in my own way. And I would say that, you know, I think about that a lot, even having come into the auction world where, you know, I did not grow up in the auction world. My parents were not art collectors. We lived a lovely life. So I'm not pretending that we did not have a nice life, but there is a nice life. And there are people who are collecting in the art world.
Right.
And it's a world that still to this day is 0.0001%. I mean, it is the top of the top. And, you know, a lot of times, especially in my early 20s, I would overhear conversations about people who were buying art at $1 million or $2 million, which frankly in this day and age is nothing anymore. I mean, people buy art for $100 million now. And just feeling like I had to nod as if this was something that I was very comfortable with, where in fact I had no idea what I was talking about.
Right.
And I really feel like I kind of hid my southernness. I know that sounds kind of funny in a way. Like I didn't really tell a lot of people I was from Louisiana, or when they would ask, they'd say, "Oh, you're from New Orleans." And I wouldn't disagree, but I wouldn't agree. I would just sort of nod and say, "Louisiana is so great." I did not grow up in New Orleans. I grew up in Lake Charles, which is a small town. And so
Charles. Yes.
Oh, you do?
Yes.
Yeah. So you'll know it is not New Orleans,
no.
You know? And it was funny because when I was writing the book, I think I'd always been so afraid that someone would say to me, "Well, Lydia's not from New Orleans. She's from Lake Charles." Mm. And so I felt like the book for me was such an opportunity to clear it all up and to really take ownership of how proud I am to be from a small town in Louisiana and to have made it in a career in an incredible company in New York. Like I'm very proud of my career and I've worked hard in my career. And I want the women who grew up in Lake Charles or small towns anywhere in middle America or a small town, frankly, anywhere in the world to know that hard work does pay off and networking does pay off. And all these things along the way can pay off if you work hard and really commit to your dreams and going after them. And so I think I feel comfortable with who I am. And I feel like I walk into a room and whether or not people want to talk to me about the LSU win, I don't really care. I need to talk about it immediately. And I do try to remind people that's who I am and where I'm from, because that's such a huge part of me. So that's a very roundabout way of saying, I definitely understand being outside of that comfort zone, but I feel like you will literally be your authentic self only when you are true about who you are and where you're from and what that looks like. Mm-hmm. And you're right, not everyone's going to like it. And certainly there are times when I feel that I, you know, become a slightly different person to fit in here and there. And that's of my own comfort level. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I do think being authentic and being who you are and who you want to be in your work environment is going to be as important to you personally as in the sort of fulfillment part of your career and your life as it is to those around you truly understanding who you are.
In your career, what turned out to be more challenging than you expected and what was easier than you expected?
I think in terms of things that I found to be more challenging, you know, it's interesting, especially having worked in a company for so long, and obviously I have a lot of friends who work in corporate America, the internal politics of a company are so important. And I think when I first started working, I didn't really realize that. Mm. I didn't realize how important it was that you maintained good friendships and that you kept your temper under control, even when you wanted to be angry with someone. Because especially if you work at a company as long as I do, like it's a long-term investment.
Right.
Your goals and your friendships, like you never know who's going to be moving around within the company and who yesterday was this person is now the president. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the most important lessons that I've learned that I was not aware of and that at times was challenging, but now I really try to make an effort in a huge way, and I feel like I have successfully done that here, is the internal politics of your job and maintaining good relationships throughout and not being the person who's constantly stirring the pot and gossiping and spreading rumors about people. Because ultimately, especially in a company, everyone knows it's you. So just try to keep a lid on it. And then the sort of easier part, I would say, I don't know. I mean, I feel like anything's necessarily been easy. I do think there's just been a lot of discovery along the way. Mm-hmm. And it's been exciting. So I don't know necessarily that it's been easy, but I would say every time something that has seemed challenging unlocks, I get excited about it. And then I feel like it gives me renewed energy in my job and in my life.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is there anything that maybe we haven't covered that you feel passionate about and you want to mention it and you want to just say it and you feel like, I've been waiting to say this? Or anything that you think like women need to know as they're navigating their professional careers that we haven't touched on?
Yes. I have two things to say.
Awesome.
The first thing I would say is there are no bigger allies than the females that you work with. Mm. So do not ever turn against them, even if you think that they are being poisonous to you. Mm-hmm. A much better strategy is bringing them under the fold. The ruder they are, the nicer you get. And I truly believe that. I know it sounds crazy, but a lot of times the reason that people are poisonous towards you is because they feel threatened by you. And if you bring them into the fold and make them part of your journey, that dissipates and then they become loyal and a huge advocate for you. And those are the people who, frankly, can firebomb your career. So be very careful and make sure that the people who you perceive to be the people who could be quote unquote enemies are not. And always be the person who's the bigger person. You will never lose anything from being the bigger person.
That's so powerful. I mean that.
I've seen that happen time and time again. And in my 20s, I didn't realize that. Mm-hmm. And in my 30s, I started to realize that. And now that I'm 41, mm-hmm. or am I 42 now? I'm in my 40s. I'm in my early 40s. Mm-hmm. I will say that I employ that strategy all the time. And it does work. Mm-hmm. So that would be the first thing I would say. And the second thing would say, under the theory of being the biggest promoter of myself, I hope that every single person listening to this podcast will buy the most powerful woman in the room as you. Even if you are the most powerful woman in the room, I hope you will pass it along to somebody who needs it, because it really is supposed to inspire you. And it's a book on selling. So if I don't sell it, then I haven't done my job. So those are my two things to tell you.
I absolutely love that it all correlates and ties in. It makes sense for sure. And I know that some of our audience is already out there reading it. One of my personal friends, she posted it on Instagram. I think it might have been a couple months ago. And I was like, oh, I'm going to see that. That's awesome. So yeah, people have it in their hands. So that means that all the goodness that you've learned throughout this time, you're going to be able to actually share it with people, and they're taking it in and they're going to be using it. So that's awesome. Lydia, thank you so much. This has been a really fun conversation that's gone in quite a few directions that I didn't expect, but I absolutely love it. This is what I thrive off of. So before we go, let everybody know if there is a way that they can keep in touch with you.
So my LinkedIn is Lydia Finette. I have a website, which is lydiafinette.com. And my book is available on Amazon under The Most Powerful Woman in the Room is You by Lydia Finette. And feel free to follow me on Instagram, because I always love getting new Instagram followers.
And what's your Instagram?
Lydia Finette. Ah, I think I'm the only Lydia Finette in the world, so I actually get everything that I want with my name. It's
Don't
amazing.
You just love that? Yes. All right, my good people. I really hope that you guys are enjoying these conversations as much as I'm enjoying bringing them to you. That's a wrap on another chat in our Cracking Corporate series. And I really, really want to hear your feedback. So hit me up in the DMs on Instagram, or just post what your thoughts are from these Cracking Corporate conversations. And let me know. Post and tag me. And as always, be good.